Tonight, Ken F. is our guest speaker. He will share his experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now. Ken?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ken. And if you want to know about these, a lot of people call me Aloha Ken because I did live in Hawaii for a couple of years. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad to be here. And it's a privilege and an honor to be asked to participate in a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't really know where to go with this. I prayed about it because, you know, I have a story that it goes a lot of different directions, I guess. To begin with, I when I was a young kid, I remember screaming at my parents on two occasions that I would never drink because I'd never had my kids raised the way I was raised, the way we were raised. And you know, but you know, once I got into the Navy and the booze ran rampant in there, and I wanted to fit in and I wanted to be like everybody else. But you know, before I even get started, I just want everybody to know, especially there was a lot of new people here. And if you're anything like me, I had a lot of fear when I got sober. Kind of like I have fear right now, but I really did. I wouldn't talk. I didn't know how to act around people when I was sober, and I had been sober before this time, but I had been out there drinking for so many years in between that I just felt like that cool kid. And when I got sober, I was scared to ask a girl to a dance or anything else, you know. So I had to go overcome a lot of fear when I got sober. I got sober in San Francisco in 1993. And, you know, I spent 4 years there in Alcoholics Anonymous before I moved to Visalia, where I live now. And, you know, to begin with, when I got sober this time, I just went to meetings, and sometimes I debated on whether to go because I was so scared. But I knew that I had to go to... So I knew I had to go to meetings because I had been sober before, and meetings was an important part of my sobriety. And at any rate, I started going to these meetings, and my first commitment in AA, I was sober about 6 months, and I used to go to a meeting called Post the Nation, which isn't there anymore. And this guy came up to me and he asked me, he said, how long have I been sober? And I said, about 6 months. He said, we need a new literature person. And he said, would you be it? And I said, I don't know. So he went in and told the group, I said yes, and I think he misunderstood me. And you know, I walked home, fear hit me right away, but when I was walking home, I remember being sober before, and I got a warm feeling inside, you know? And that feeling was like, you know, when I was sober before and I was a part of, I felt like I belonged, and it made a lot of difference to me. Then let me get back to where I got started drinking. You know, when I was in the Navy, a lot of things happened, you know. In boot camp, they rushed us through because of the Vietnam War. So we didn't get no liberty, and so all the guys, when we got out of boot camp, they said the first two things they're going to do is they're going to get drunk and they're going to get laid. And you know, I got on this airplane and I'm going flying home to leave before I go to my next duty station. And I'm in this first class, like whatever it is, where they serve the free champagne. And they come by and they ask me what I wanted to drink. And I'm still that scared little boy because I haven't had anything to drink. And I said, I'm not old enough. And they said, there's a war going on. You're up in the airplane. And you got a uniform on. You can have whatever you want. And I didn't know what the word is. So, you know, in the movies, they drink martini. I said, give me a martini. And I hated it. But you're allowed two drinks, so I said, give me one more. So then they kept filling up my champagne glass, you know, and they talked about that airship guy in the front, you know, in front of the seat in front of you. When we landed in O'Hare Field in Chicago, I reached for it, but I didn't make it. So the airline service coming got me. They took me to the back. They had these seats pulled down. They told me to sit down. They were going to clean me up, probably get in trouble at the airport, because I had my uniform on, and I went to sit down, and the seat went back up, so I had it on the floor. So they picked me up and put me in a chair, and they could turn cold and cold towel on my head until we landed. But you know, prior to that, they were, the airline stewardesses were sitting on my lap and taking pictures. Now this is that scared little boy in school that doesn't know how to be around women, doesn't know what to say. Alcohol changed me instantly, you know. And from that time on, you know, alcohol was a part of my life, except for when I was in these rooms. You know, I've had numerous jobs, hundreds of jobs. And alcohol, you know, when I got out of the, actually, back up again. You know, I was in the Hawaii station there, and then I got transferred to a ship, and then our ship went to Vietnam. We'd go back and forth to the Philippines to pick up supplies all the time. And every time we went in there, me and a bunch of other guys, we just we'd drink. That's all we did. I never seen anything other than the bars and the women over there. And we made a pact that we were going to go and do something. We were going to go on a tour, a bunch of us, and it was our last trip there, I think. The trip prior to that, there was a guy who slept right next to me on the ship, and we had him marked down AOL, you know, absent without leave. And because he never showed up, and it's just like in the movies, our ship was pulling away, and here comes a whole bunch of cars down towards the end of the pier, and they got out with both our horns and told us to come back in. And we come back in, and they wanted me to identify this guy's body they found. So they robbed this guy, and they slit his belly open, and threw him in a sewage ditch. So the very next time that we went in, and I told you we were going to go on this tour, so we took our check over and got him transferred into pesos. And when we were coming back to the ship, there were seven of us, I think. And I was in there, and one of the gals was seen us walking down the street, and she grabbed me and pulled me inside. So I got separated from my guys, and I'm by myself. So I got on this jeepney to go back to my ship. And just me and the driver, and we started off, and two guys jumped in behind us, you know, in the back of the jeepney. And, you know, we was on our way, and he started to take this shortcut, and I said, no, stay on the main road. I said, no, I said, no, you stay on the jeep, the road. And so he pulled off anyway, and the guy behind me, put his arm around me and put a knife up to my throat and told the driver to reach over and get my wallet that I just cashed my check with. And so naturally, I just kicked him in the head. And then all of a sudden, I felt that knife up to my throat, and then it was just like a state of shock. I just snapped and remembered what happened to the guy the last time he was there, and they found him dead in the sewage ditch. And I just knew I was dead, you know. I just broke. They just kicked me out of this jeepney and threw my wallet out after they took the money. And, you know, that's just one experience. And that happens when, because I like to drink, you know. Because, you know, I got sent to, after I left there, I got transferred back to San Diego to a math school. And one thing led to another, but, you know, they were going to send me back to Vietnam again. And I said, no, you can't do that. I did two campaigns over there already. I said, yeah, we can do whatever we want. And I said, but you're not. I went to the captain. I went to the chaplain. I went to everybody else. But I didn't want to go back. And they were going to send me back anyway. So they sent me to Fort Wainini for combat training. And I went through that. And then they sent me to San Bernardino to catch a flight back over to Vietnam. And so we get to San Bernardino at the weekend, so they told me to go out and party until Monday. And I went out and I didn't come back. And, you know, I drank in the bars for 2 weeks until my money ran out for, I don't know, a few days. And then I moved in with this lady for a couple of days, and then she kicked me out. And then I ended up living with the winos. And here I am, 20-year-old kid, living out there with the winos. And I'm wanting to work, but I have the military ID, and I'm over the hill, and I don't know what to do. So, at any rate, I turned myself in after 23 days because I didn't want to be considered a deserter. And they put me into jail there, and the guard seen me shaking, and he said, what do we do with this guy? He said, give him a couple aspirins. They give me a couple of aspirins, and they give me a cup of water, and all the water shook out before I could get to my mouth. And so the guy said, well, let's take you to the hospital. So they had an armed guard walk me over to the hospital, and the nurse said, you don't have to be here. We're giving these shots, and when he drank some Peralahan, he ain't going to work. And said, I have to be here. So during that night, I went into the hallucinations, and I had a lot of hallucinations, but this was the first one. But I went into the DT. They didn't give me an apple, whatever they're supposed to. I went into the DTs anyway, and I seen this real beautiful woman on me. She was on me, and she was naked, and all of a sudden she turned into a witch with very long fingernails. And those fingernails went into my skin, and I could really feel the pain. I mean, that's just, and it was so real, and it was so scary. And, you know, they took me by ambulance the next day into the naval air station, and they gave me a choice of, and they actually tied me down to a bed, just like in that movie, if you ever seen it with James Woods, and My Name is Bill W. And I cringe when I see that movie, but I shook like that, and I was tied down. And I was 20 years old, and they give me a chance of going to rehab or going to the grip. And I ended up going to the rehab. And so we're restricted to base. And we stole some Liberty card. And the chief would let you, he didn't give you an abuse. Everybody there was on an abuse but me and a couple other guys, because he gives the honor system. And so we'd go over to the bowling alley and we would drink our ice. And somehow the chief found out, and the chief had 5 years of sobriety in AA already. And him and a guy named Dick Jewell from Long Beach formed this group down there. So anyway, so he put me on interviews. So this guy, we sold those Liberty cards and we went to downtown. And I got separated from the group and I went into this bar and ordered a drink. Actually, I just ordered a glass of beer and craft beer, and I drank it, and the bartender said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, give me another beer." He said, "Your face is getting red like that light bulb." I said, "Just give me another beer, it's hot in here." And it was a real long bar, so we had to walk a long way to get to the bathroom. So he gave me that other beer, and I started drinking it, and he said, "Your face is red, that light bulb." And I started to walk back to that bathroom, and you know, and I swear to God, I thought that my heart was going through my chest. I got my hand on my heart. And I'm going, and finally I put my other hand up there because I know my heart's coming out of my chest. And I guess that's why they give you an EKG before they give you to make sure your heart was standing if you do happen to drink on it. And you know, we did that, and I did that. And 3 weeks later, a friend of mine said, "Let's go to North Hollywood. They got this strip club and stuff, and we can drink." And I said, "You were in the hospital when you drank all that stuff." He says, "Yeah, but," he said, "you just sip it, you become immune to it." It don't work. But you know, believe it or not, I thought I was too young to be an alcoholic. After going through all that, even during that period of time, I was selling blood already because the Navy didn't give me enough money to drink on. And I drank, but you know, I just drank. And so anyway, I got out of the Navy, I got home, and I got put in jail 3 times in 2 weeks. Because back there, they put you in jail just for walking down the street if you stagger, you know? And the third time they arrested me, they had me for being a different guy. They said, "Well, you're drunk anyway," so they threw me back in there. And that scared me, because the judge had already told me the second time, if he seen me again in 6 months, he was going to send me to prison for 6 months. And that scared me. And so it's a holiday weekend, so I'm in jail for 4 days. And all these guys are teasing me about going to prison. And I didn't think it was funny at all. And so I got there, and they had this pro tem judge, and then the other judge was gone. So he said, "I can't find any paperwork. Have you ever been here before?" And I said, "No, sir, Your Honor." So I got $1 in court costs. But you know, I did come back to AA that time. My aunt told me that I forgot about AA. And my aunt told me they had started a new program at the VA hospital in Marion, Indiana. It was a mental hospital for veterans, but they had an alcohol program, substance abuse program there. And I went there, and I used to not think I was locked up in a mental institution, but that's where they put you because they don't know, they had just started it, they didn't know what to do with you until they processed your paperwork. They had me in the network, locked down in a locked ward for 13 days. And I really thought I was going nuts by the time I got out of there. But you know, I got into AA, and I stayed in AA there for 2.5 years, and and you know things were going pretty good. And I'd like to say I stayed sober for that 2.5 years. But 1 year and 4 months after I got sober, I put a woman in front of my sobriety, and I drank 1 pound. You know, I mean, actually for about 3 hours. And I wrecked my car going home, put 32 stitches in my face, and crawled back into the room through AA, called my sponsor. And I lasted for about another year. And I did the same thing again. And so, you know, I knew that I was not going to live like that. I knew I was going to drink. And I laid awake all night. I went into these rooms. I got away from the program. I quit going to my commitments and the meetings because of this woman I was with. And before you know it, I'm back. And when things didn't work out, and I couldn't accept it, you know, I got into that self-pity mode. And self-pity is a joke for me. And I, at any rate, I'd lay awake at night and I couldn't sleep. And I talked to God, and finally I told God I can't live like this anymore. But I don't want my friends to see me drink. I've been with them for 2.5 years. They're good people. So anyway, I waited till I drove across the state line and got into Missouri. And I was on my way to California, and I found a motel close to a bar so I wouldn't have to drive. So I got this room, and then I went to the bar, just a little rinky-dink bar, and I said, well, this ain't business. So there was another bar, and they said, it's up there. So I drove up this mountain, and I went to this bar. Those guys up there are trying to kill each other. And I thought, well, this ain't my kind of bar either. You know, fighting with broken bottles and stuff. So I got out of there, and I'm coming down the mountain, and I drove my car up the Ozark Mountain. A tree trunk stopped me from going all the way down. And that was my very first drunk after leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. So if any of you people here think you're too young to be an alcoholic, you know, think about what can happen. Because when I was in these rooms and I was younger, and I heard some of the stories that go on around here, I thought, my God, if that happened to me, I'd quit too. But you see, I'm not done yet. You see, I drank, and I didn't need no excuse to drink. It didn't have to be a birthday, or I didn't have to lose a job. I didn't have to do anything. I just drank. And I drank all the time. And then it got to where I had to drink because I shook so much. And that's my story. I've been, like I said, I got sober this time in San Francisco. But I got sober in Seattle 11 months. After I had that car wreck, I ended up in a hospital in Portland, Oregon, in the VA hospital. I stayed there for 4 weeks. They took a piece of my liver out. They thought I was jaundiced because my eyes was yellowish. And then they sent me to another halfway house in Aberdeen, Washington. And some people from Seattle seen me there, and there was only two of us in that whole halfway house that was sober. They said, we got to get you out of that place. And they took me to their house and put me up and gave me their basement. And I stayed there, and he became my sponsor, and his wife got me into a college in Seattle. And I got back into AA again for 1.5 years. But then I drank again. You know, and you know, my drinking took me a lot of places. I'm from Indiana. After I got out of the service, I ended up in Florida. And I ended up in Oklahoma and Alabama, and I all across the country. You know, I've worked here, I've worked there, stay in a mission here or a Salvation Army there, whatever it took. In other words, I just existed. And I didn't have a life. You know, I just never had a life. And you know, that's another thing about jumping ahead a little bit. When I got sober this time, by doing my inventory and looking back over my life, the only time I've really had a life is when I was in these rooms and trying to work a program. I came in here a few times just to get off the street, and that don't count. But you know, and when I got sober this time, I remembered things that I learned along the way. I had two sponsors when I was sober in Indiana, 2.5 years, and one was at a young people's meeting because I was 23 years old. And they kept telling me, do this, do that. And he did this step every week. There was 13 of us around these tables. And I said, yeah, I did this, I did that. And finally, it took me a while, but I got my fourth and fifth step done. And then I got all of them done. And they're always coming around laughing and joking before the meeting, just like we do. And you know, and it came my turn to share. And I said, I did everything you told me. How come I don't feel like you do? How come I'm still scared? How come I... You know, and this idiot was my sponsor. He was at the other end of the table, and he wrote down on his piece of paper, and he put down KISS. And that's why I said he was an idiot. He wasn't. But you know, they passed it around to me, and I seen this word and said, KISS. And I said, what's your problem? You know, and they said, open it up. I unfolded it and said, keep it simple, stupid. I had no idea what that meant. I mean, I do today, but at that time, it was just weird. But then I had an older sponsor that had been sober for 14 years at that time, and he always had a thing. He said he never saw a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And so today, I remember my gratitude, because, you know, whenever I get in a bind here today, or things ain't going my way, or I start feeling sad, or like whatever reason, if I can just stop and look back at where I came from, I have no reason not to be grateful. And I am a grateful alcoholic today. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do have a life today. You know, after I went back out another time, I've had so many jobs. I've had good jobs in nice hotels, different places, and from night auditor and night manager to managing motels. You know, I've had some decent jobs, but they didn't last long. You know, and most of it was when I was sober. But a lot of times I got decent jobs when I was drinking, and. So I ended up working with Carnival. And that's because they didn't care if I drank. And here's how that came about. I was in Indiana, and I couldn't afford that $15 a week for my rent. And I had a nice apartment, but I couldn't afford it. I mean, I didn't have the money for it. So I had a friend. Let me go back again. I'm sorry to keep jumping around. I haven't spoke for a while. At any rate, when I was just before I graduated from high school, and that's why I told you, I yelled at my parents, said I'll never drink, because they always had money for booze, but we went to school with hand-me-down clothes and holes in our shoes. We never seen a doctor or a dentist ever, unless it was an emergency. And they came in drunk, and I wasn't home yet. And I had been at practice for graduation for high school. I was the only one in my family who graduated from high school. And he said, what do you think you're doing? I said that. And I hated him. And he said, I said, I'm fixing something to eat. And he said, you want something to eat, you get here at supper time. And I yelled at him. I said, as long as I live in this house, I got a right to eat. And I started to reach for the refrigerator and came in and slammed it shut. And he hit me with his fist. And like, we lived in a basement because he never did build the house on top of it. He hit me, and I hit the metal cabinet where our dishes were, and it fell over, and I landed on the floor, the cement floor right next to a beer bottle, and it was sitting up, and the neck was broke off of it. It could have went right through my back. And then he grabbed me by the head and the hair and yanked me and pulled. We didn't even have doors in this basement. They just had curtains. And he pulled me through the curtain and started pounding on me, and I didn't do anything. And then my mom came in and tried to stop him. And when she did, he pushed her and she hit the corner of the door. She couldn't walk for 3 days after that. And I got up and I pushed him, all 111 pounds of me, I pushed him. And I said, you can hit on me all you want, but leave her alone. He said, in the morning I want you out of here and I don't ever want you back again. And this guy how I got into the Carnival group, somehow he found out about it, but his brother was my buddy. And so he said, you're not going anywhere, you're going to stay with me and my wife until you graduate, which was 3 weeks away. So I did. But when I got in that jam, I found out he had a couple of Carnival games out there, So everybody in his family was working there. So he didn't have room for me, but he picked me up with his hide and homes. You know, so I started riding around all over the country. Could drink as much as I wanted, as long as I was making money for him. But you know, the very first day on the job here, I'm working there and I had this little rinky-dink mini basketball game where I'm just standing there waiting for people to come up and give me their money and shoot the ball in the basket. It's pretty easy, huh? So I sit there from 10 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the morning, and the boss comes by to collect all the money that I made for him that day. And he says, "Where's your money?" I said, "Here." He took it and threw it at me. He said, "Go get you something to eat." Out of 13 hours of work, I made $4, and I'm only supposed to get 1/4 of it, which would be $1. So his boss came by the next morning. He says, "Do you let people know you're here, or do you just stand here like a store clerk and wait for them?" He said, "You got to make a little noise." So I got a few drinks in me, and I started making a lot of noise. And I started making a lot of money. And the boss was getting mad at this other guy because I was out grossing 2 or 3 times and having sheep firm dinner every day. So the next week he gave me a job where I could make half of my money. And there's 4 guys in there and I'm out grossing all of them. Well, I didn't know you could have fun and make money too. I mean, I'm partying every night. And I was never into drugs. But the boss would come by and go, "You know, you work many long hours and you know you're going to drink all night long. But you're not going to make no money if you're half dead when you come to work." So he furnished the seat. And he would come by and he'd tell him, "You got to give me your aspirin bottle," what he called it. You know, believe me, that was an old, that life got old after a while, you know. But you know, whenever I was in a bind and I needed to make some money, if there was a carnival in town, I could go and I could tell them who I worked for in the past and they would hire me. Girl, I was pretty good at it, you know. Giving away those teddy bears for love affairs, I did it all over. But you know, I kept ending up back in these rooms. And I have a friend in who moved up here to this area from Bakersfield. Now, he lived down there. He did live down there about 3 or 4 years ago. I told him I used to live there, too. I lived in that park on 19th Street with the other winos. Mm. You know, so my drinking got me around a lot of different places. I've been hospitalized for pancreatitis. I have an uncle who's in the program now, and he's 90 years old, and he's almost died several times recently, but he tells me, you know, he says, "I remember when you were smarter than you were now." And he said, "I don't mean it to hurt your feelings, but," he says, "I think alcohol did something to you." And I know that they say when you shake and when you drink a lot and you start shaking, you lose some brain cells. And then for some reason, you know, I even forgot this on my inventory. I was hospitalized in San Francisco for 5 days. And they wouldn't let me go home because of my fever, but they didn't know what was causing it. Well, it was the booze, that alcohol poisoning, but I had 105 degrees temperature, and they'd get it down for a few hours, and it would come back up again. And I'm sure that wasn't very good for my brain cells, because you know, that was alcohol poisoning. And when I come into the room this time, it was, I had to defuse this time too. Because you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I try to show my gratitude by being in service today. And I have keys to half the church, well, it's an exaggeration, but 4 or 5 churches in Visalia and Tulare, because I get there early and I try to help out. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. And I have friends, you know, that have been in these rooms and they went back out and they're no longer with us. I have a friend, a good friend from Hawaii, that had 20 years working for Hawaiian Airlines, and he just went out last year. And you know, he's not with us anymore. You know, I have a friend who was, when I was in San Francisco, I had enabled us, and that's the only reason I stayed in San Francisco, I mean, because this lady, she used to, I used to come by there because I did have a decent job in a hotel then. And I'm coming home and I stopped there for a drink on the way home at 11 o'clock at night. Because it was just a block from the hotel. And she said, you know, I see you here all the time. I don't really know you, but she said, I don't know anybody in here. Would you stay here until somebody comes in I know? I said, I don't have the money to stay here. She said, I'll buy you a drink. You know, so I did. And, you know, and she continued to do that for a long time after that. And then she made her husband give me a job carpeting carpets. And here I'm 134 pounds at that time. And he's 230 pounds, and he expected me to lug that carpet in, up and down those places in San Francisco. So I did that for a while, but you know, in any rate, they're the ones who told me if I had a little cocaine in me, I could drink more. So that's how I ended up being able to drink a lot in San Francisco. Not because I was doing the drugs, because I was their runner. I went after their drugs and I could get free drinks. And I started doing that for a lot of bartenders. Not once did I think about me getting in trouble. I didn't know I was going to get in a lot of trouble if I got caught doing that. But I just knew that I wanted to drink. And I did whatever it took to drink. You know, when I was with these carnivals, this guy that came by San Francisco, and I was in a different hotel then, he was this woman and they were going to get married, and he asked me to move to Monterey with him. And I said, well, I don't know. And I said, they owe me some money. Well, take what they owe me and come on. So I just took the money out of the till and I left. And so I went down there with them, and him and his old lady showed up after we got down there. So his sister had a house there, and his brother already had a house set, a bed set up in the garage. So he asked me to come over, so we went there and stayed. And we all three had beds set up in his sister's garage. So, at any rate, it's these guys I worked with, so I trusted these guys. But then they had all these locals come in that I don't know, and we had a big party there. Now, this guy had just gotten out of prison in New York, and he came. I don't know him from that. But he said, take me over to this store. I took him over to this store, Safeway or something. He went down to the liquor aisle, filled up the cart with booze. Half gallon, whatever. And then he took and pushed the cart out the door. He forgot to pay for it. And he put it in the car. So then he said, drive me over to Long's over there. I drove him over to Long's. He filled the cart up again and just walked out. We didn't get caught. I don't know why. We drove back to that house. And so we had a party that night. And we stopped at a bar. And I grabbed this gal and she went with me. I didn't know she was only 18 because she was in a bar. And we went there, and we were there all night, and the party was going on, and everybody was in there. And then finally, the next day, these guys that I didn't know said they were going to rape her. And I said, no, you're not. You know, and so they took up this lead pipe, and he swung it in my hand. And I put my hand up here like this, and it hit my finger. And that's where my hand moved away. And the next time I woke up, I was in a pool of blood, laying on a mattress in that bed, in that garage. And the guy that had just gotten out of prison wanted to cut me up in little pieces and put me in a plastic bag and drop me off to Monterey Pier. You know, these are the kind of things I got myself into from drinking. And everybody has their own experiences. But you see, I went where the booze was, and I didn't care. You know, and that's why I have so much gratitude for these rooms today. Like I said, I existed out there. I didn't really have a life. I never had a life, except when I was in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I can't say that, you know, nobody knows what will happen to anybody that goes back out there. When I was sober in San Francisco, and this gal used to come into the bar all the time where I had my neighbor, and I was always sitting on that bar stool. And she said, come in, she said, I've been sober for 10 days, and I feel good. She said, you ought to try it. And she came back and she said, well, I got 20 some days, and I feel good. She said, you ought to try it. But I didn't. But she always went back out drinking, and she always came back. So I'm at that meeting with those 500 people up there, because I'm so full of fear, I'm trying to overcome my fear. I don't know how to act around people when I'm sober. So I'm up there person that suffered, when she found me out of all those people, she came up there and she gave me a big hug and she said, I got 10 days. And I said, I don't see you. I've been sober for a year and a half. I haven't seen you. Should I go to daytime meetings? And so 2 weeks later, she went back out again. She was at the bar across the street from the bus station and she got shot in the head and she's no longer with us. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen to you. You know, it don't have to be physical things. I mean, I just lost too many friends. I've seen too many things that can happen. And so, you know, I never thought I would ever be sober again. When I got sober this time, I'm laying in a bed in San Francisco, and I had tried to quit drinking before that, but I'm not going back to AA. I just shook, and I tried to get juice or water or something in me because I was dehydrated and I couldn't. And so this one time I made sure I had straws so that I could drink out of them, you know. But I couldn't pour the stuff into the cup. I was shaking so much. And that's when I was in the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and like I said, all my neighbors were dying. They were giving me all these free booze and I looked in the mirror and I looked like death was over my face with grayish and my eyes were back in their sockets. And I remember saying out loud, I said, God, is this how I'm going to die too? And I just got on my knees and I asked God for help. I have no idea what I said, you know. But you know, I got back into that bed and I didn't do anything. I never called anybody, didn't do nothing. But the phone rang. And the phone rang, it was the guy who owns the bar. He said, get yourself together, I'm going to take you to the hospital. I don't want you dying like our friend. Like I said, I didn't call anybody, he called me. And so I started to, you know, I said, okay. But then he didn't show up when I thought he was supposed to, so I had to get ready to go have a drink, but I needed a drink. And I thought, well, I'll call him and see if he's coming. And I called, he said, I got busy, you know, I'll be right there. And he took me there to the emergency room at Fort Riley in San Francisco. And that's how I got back in these rooms. You know, I told myself I'm going to go through this halfway. They told me to go for outpatient, go to halfway out, and go to AA and do this and something else. And so anyway, I made myself a commitment that I was going to go to this halfway house and I was going to complete the 6-month program. I lasted 60 days. They called me into the office and said I was going to have to move and go to another house. They own 5 houses. And I said, that took me this long just to be able to talk to these guys. I'm too scared to go somewhere else. And they said, you have to. I said, I didn't do anything wrong. They said, well, you still have to go. So at any rate, I said, I'm not going to do that. I told myself, I ain't going to do that. I didn't have no money. I had $2 and a pack of cigarettes. I think I even had a candy bar. And so they told me the next week I had to leave. So I'm walking to my outpatient program in Fort Riley at the VA hospital. And it's kind of a rainy day, but I'm walking anyway because I wanted to talk to God. And I didn't know what to do. And I'm talking to God and I'm trying the long version of serenity prayer and acceptance and all this stuff. And I remember telling God, I said, I believe. And then I said, well, I think I believe. And then I'm telling myself, well, if I think I believe, I don't believe, but I'm willing to believe. All these thoughts are going on in my mind. And when I'm going across the Golden Gate Park there, past all those trees, you could see some sunlight. And when I got past that sunlight and I looked up, I could see a rainbow. And I seen that rainbow and I just knew it was going to be okay. You know, I just got a warm feeling inside like it's all right. And you know, it has been ever since. You know, I was blessed with the chance to, a lot of good things have happened to me. And a lot of bad things have happened to me in sobriety. But the good far outweighs the bad. But real quickly, I've had a settlement from the government when I was sober a couple of years, I guess. And so I decided to go to Hawaii, and I did. You know, for 5 days or something. That's 7 days, I think. But anyway, I had that settlement, and my boss told me, he said, don't take all that money with you. I only had $3,000, I think. I took some money, and I put $2,500 in this lockbox, and he said, keep it here, and he said, that way you won't be broke when you come home. So I put $2,500 in that safety deposit box at the hotel. And I came back and it was gone. And you know, this is another blessing that God could give me, because you know, I could have went into rage, I could have run, I could have tried to kill him, I could have done a lot of things. But I just did a little mini inventory. And I talked with God. And I went to a meeting, and I seen this guy that I knew. I mean, I didn't know him. I just know that he sounded like he had a good message when he shared. And I asked him, would you go have coffee with me? And he said, sure. And after the meeting, we went and had coffee, and we talked about it. Actually, I didn't go through the talking, but you know, I felt better afterwards. And I knew how to do this because I had an open mind when I was in these meetings. And that was a big part of my sobriety when I got sober in San Francisco. At that particular time, they talked a lot about the honesty and the open-mindedness and the willingness. And if you're new and you don't like the way your life is going today, if you can be honest with yourself and you don't like it, you know, it doesn't hurt to open your mind up a little bit and listen to what's going on here. And have a little willingness to try and give it a try. Because you don't know what's going to happen unless you try it, you know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm certainly grateful to be here. If it wasn't for these rooms, I don't know what, I don't know that I'd even be alive. But you know, I've had a lot of blessings given to me. I have a lot of the things I used to fantasize about on that bar through. I have a family, I have a home. I'm not living in the mission anymore, or in one of those park benches. I have, and it's only because of these rooms. And it's because I had a little bit of trust in you people. I had nowhere else to go, you know. And when I got sober this time, before I looked in that mirror, I'm looking at that weight to kill myself here, and I'm looking at AA, and I couldn't do anything. That's when I just got on my knees and asked God for help. You know, at any rate, I just came into these rooms, and I had so much fear I couldn't even ask somebody to be my sponsor. This guy would take me to meetings, and he was doing this, and I was asking for help and all this stuff. And finally, he didn't even ask, and he just yelled at me. He said, you want me to be your sponsor? I said, sure. I just didn't know how to ask you. You know? And he's the one that got me through the steps. You know, I kept prolonging my fourth step. And he started taking me to the dry dock. That's a clubhouse and down by the marina. And they had a fourth step workshop every Monday. He'd take me there. You know, he got me through all of my steps, you know. You know, I've just had so many blessings, you know. I don't know where to begin, you know. If you don't think your life can change, all you have to do is get in here and give yourself a chance, you know. I got to Hawaii. Another thing, my wife gave me, and I ended up getting married, and that's another trip, because, that's another trip. I would see all these women at this meeting, and there were 500 people there, and they're out there, they're flirting with the guys, just like the guys are flirting with them. And I'm too scared to talk to them, so that probably saved my ass, probably. Because I wanted to take them home, but, you know, I was too scared to talk to them, you know. And so I go home, and one night I can remember laying in bed, and I'm talking to God. And that's another thing that I did every night when I got sober. I found this King to Believe book. And I had one of my sponsors many years before that, when I was young, he said he read something out of the big book every night before he went to bed. That way, no matter what he went through during the day, he had good thoughts in his head when he got sober. I mean, you know, when he went to sleep. And so I just come out of the hospital with the DTs. I didn't have much going up there. So I got that King of Belief book, and I could read those little short stories, and they're spiritual. And I went to, I read something out of that book every night for over a year. Every night before I went to bed. Anyway, I came home from that meeting, and I'm thinking that I'm talking to God, and I said, you know, I'd sure like to have one of those ladies with me, but you know, and I'd like to have this, and I'd like to have that, but she said, you know, but if I did, I wouldn't be able to go all my meetings, I wouldn't be able to do this, I wouldn't be able to do that. But I said, if I could find somebody to be there, and always be there when I came home, and I could do this, and I could do that. But then I said, God, that wouldn't be fair. I can't have my cake and eat it too. So I just told God that night I was going to be single for the rest of my life. And three weeks later, I met my wife. So it didn't last very long. But you know, miracles happen in these rooms. I used to hear people all the time when I was in these different meetings. They always said, "Don't quit before the miracle happens." And I used to think, "You don't know where I came from. You don't know what I've been through." You know. Anyway, I don't know. I keep jumping all over the place. I don't know even how much more time I have. But I want to tell everybody, thanks for having me here. I appreciate it. It's really an honor to participate in the meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.